This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You know, there's always this tug of war between, do you start from the edges of a political spectrum and work inward, or do you start from the middle and try to get bipartisan support from the get-go?
The 2016 disagreement between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders over the best energy mix to help us get to a 100% renewable future sure does seem antiquated these days, with climate change deniers and fossil fuel interests at the helm in Washington. This week on Sea Change Radio, though, we get an update on the continued divisions within the Democratic Party from Axios Energy reporter Amy Harder. We discuss how the Sanders wing of the party has been able to carve out a larger piece of the policy pie than many imagined possible, what that means for future elections, and try to sort out the stances of the leading voices on the left when it comes to natural gas and nuclear power. Then we dig into the Sea Change Radio archives and revisit our discussion with noted linguist George Lakoff as he gives a primer on climate change messaging, a lesson that's more relevant and important than ever before. I'm joined once again on Sea Change Radio by Amy Harder. Amy is an energy reporter for Axios. Amy, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So you recently wrote a piece for Axios entitled "The Left's Civil War Over Climate Change." In a nutshell, what is the left's civil war? Are environmentalists fighting each other over more than just nuclear? In the past, that's been the real troublesome spot for environmentalists to agree upon. Is nuclear energy clean? But there's more to it, in your opinion.
Correct. There's a whole host of issues that are really dividing the political left, for lack of a better term, on the issue of climate change. They all agree, first of all, I think it's important to note that they do all agree, number one, that climate change is a big problem and that something needs to be done about it. That's aggressive in policy action. But from there, a lot of the positions diverge. And at the center of it is just what type of energy mix and what type of energy technologies and resources should be part of that future. And so nuclear power is a big part of that, but it's not the only piece. Over the last couple of years, you've seen this increase in push for 100% renewable energy, not just in the electricity space, but across an entire economy. And so there's this loud political faction of groups like the Sierra Club and 350.org that are pushing this 100% renewable agenda. And that is upsetting some on the other side of this issue, who want to have a broader portfolio of energy technologies, which includes nuclear power, but also things like technology that captures carbon emissions from coal and natural gas. And you know, some people say natural gas needs to be part of the solution in the short term. So natural gas is another area where there's a lot of disagreement. And so part of this is policy and technical, and the other part is political and what can make a good rallying cry. And so there's lots of messy disagreements that are playing out in this space.
And let's take a step back for our listeners just to make sure that our language is all on the same page. Why don't you clarify the differences just for this conversation in terms of clean energy versus renewables, et cetera?
Right. Well, I mean, that's a great question, because it really is an open question and it's in the eye of the beholder what you consider clean. I mean, that's at the heart of this issue. I think renewable energy is more easily defined. That's energy sources that don't have a finite resource. So things like wind and solar power, where you get it from the sun and the wind, And so those are considered renewable energy. Whereas clean, I think that would include nuclear power, which is carbon-free when it's burned as electricity, but it is dependent upon uranium, which needs to be mined, and which is not a renewable resource. Some people also consider natural gas a cleaner fuel. Natural gas burns 50% fewer carbon emissions than coal, but it's still a carbon-emitting fossil fuel. So I think, you know, the definition is really at the heart of this battle, and it's one that really depends on who you're talking to.
Yes, I've had several guests always try to highlight the difference between clean and cleaner, as you just made. I don't know if it was consciously or unconsciously, but as a reporter, you have to be pretty careful with defining something as clean energy or cleaner energy or renewables without having a lot of pushback, I'm imagining.
Certainly. It was a conscious decision a moment ago for me to use the word cleaner, because natural gas, I think about a decade ago, it was actually considered clean. Now that we have an abundance of it here in the United States, it's considered less clean. And also given the increase in concern and data around emissions of methane. Methane is a potent greenhouse gas, many times more potent than carbon. And methane is the primary component of natural gas. So I do have to choose my words carefully in this day and age of rapid feedback on Twitter and elsewhere. Some words that you may use, me as a reporter and others may use somewhat nonchalantly, can come back to bite you. So I'm always very careful with my words. My story on this, the love of civil war over climate change, I went back over and over again, and I was careful, and I wanted to be quite cognizant of the words that I was choosing, knowing that I was going to be facing some criticism.
So let's dig into your piece a little bit more. You define different factions within the quote-unquote left. You define one as a vocal faction that's pushing for 100% renewable energy. And then on the other side, there's, I don't know how you would define these people, but they include Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, Brian Schatz of Hawaii, and former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe. This is a much more of a hybrid faction, isn't it? I guess it's hard to put your finger on it. What do these people, if we can put them in one group for argument's sake, what do they believe the role of natural gas and nuclear should be?
Well, the reason why I don't as clearly and cohesively define the positions beyond that vocal faction of groups like the Sierra Club and 350.org is because they're not easily put into one coherent policy position. In fact, I after going back and forth with everybody who I name in this column, I sought out comment to make sure that they were comfortable with how I was characterizing them. And as I did that, the way I characterized these people changed, because there isn't necessarily common ground on some of these issues outside of that loud faction. For instance, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, he's grown more critical of natural gas over the last couple of years, whereas Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii, he sees natural gas as a more viable short-term solution. And former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe goes even further to say that natural gas is a cleaner fuel than coal. You know, going 100% renewables is laughable to even discuss it. And so these politicians are on a spectrum of their positions. And so I was careful, and I changed it many times, to not be as coherent as the faction of the 100% renewables.
And one of the underlying themes that you weren't able to hit upon in your piece was Democrats are not in power right now. So how relevant is this argument? I think it's very relevant because the other side, the Republican Party, has pretty much abandoned any talk of fighting climate change in a real cohesive way. Is this all just ramping up to 2018 and 2020, or is there more to it, in your opinion, Amy?
Yeah, I mean, I think these divisions within the Democratic Party are escalating in precisely the face of this Republican-run government here in Washington. Because Democrats are not in control, you're seeing sort of different gradations of policy positions being put out there. I think if Democrats were in control, you would see some forced unity on the matter. But because they're not in control, you're seeing positions being spread out. It's not unlike, in pure political analogies, not unlike the Republican Party when it wasn't in control during the Obama administration. That party, you saw, had various positions. You had the Tea Party movement come to power. And so I think when a political party is not in control, you see more divergent positions. And then once, if and when they become in control again, you see a sort of forced compromise to appeal to the other party. That's just how politics works. I think that's part of the division here as well. The faction for the 100% renewables, they think working with Republicans or trying to make overtures to Republicans is silly and a waste of time. Whereas the others, you know, former Senate Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, for example, and Senator Whitehouse of Rhode Island, they're the types of politicians who say, well, actually, no, we do need to try to work with Republicans where we can, even though most of them refuse to acknowledge it publicly as an issue. So I think that's another component of this disagreement.
Meet me in the middle of the day, let me hear you say everything's okay. Bring me southern kisses from your room. Meet me in the middle of the night, let me hear you say everything's alright. Let me smell the moon in your perfume. Oh, gods and years will rise and fall, there's always something more. It's lost in talk, I waste my time, it's all been said before. While further down behind the masquerade, the tears have led. I don't ask for all that much, I just want someone to care.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Amy Harder. She's an energy reporter for Axios. So, Amy, back in earlier 2016, when Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders were vying for the Democratic nomination, it seemed like battle lines were being drawn in terms of natural gas. That was really one of the real dividing points when it came to energy and climate between the two candidates. And Clinton supporters were saying that the Bernie Sanders camp is being completely unrealistic, and the Bernie Sanders camp was saying that Hillary Clinton and her supporters were not caring enough about the environment and not shooting for 100% renewable solution, which they thought was attainable. So taking that debate and then fast forwarding to now, where would you say the needle has moved? Who's winning this debate in your estimation?
Well, I think the 100% renewables faction is winning. I think you're seeing a lot of companies and politicians touting this line. I think where things get a little bit messier is whether or not that's what they actually mean, whether or not they really mean 100% renewables, or what they really mean might be 80% renewables and 20% nuclear power. Now, I know that may seem to the average viewer as not that big of a difference, but when it comes to these huge companies and investment strategies, this difference can mean can be a make it or break it moment. So it is important, even though it seems like a minority percentage difference. So I think the 100% renewable crowd is winning on the politics of it, and I think, you know, it's going to see whether or not, if and when Democrats take control again, it'll be interesting to see what Democratic leader, whoever that may be, what they say, and whether or not they're pushing this 100% renewable energy or something that has a broader portfolio.
I find it very similar in some ways to the philosophical debate behind healthcare from earlier in this decade, whether we should be including a public option. And then others on the left would say, well, it's just not realistic. Should we be negotiating for the greatest good and working backwards, or should we try to kind of start in a more quote-unquote realistic spot? It felt like Hillary Clinton was echoing the Obama administration's stance on healthcare, where they did not even have the public option on the table. And Bernie Sanders was kind of saying, you know what, that's the old way of doing things, and we're in a very bifurcated political environment these days, and we have to just stand for what we believe in. So you think that that is kind of winning the day?
Yes, yes, definitely. I do think that across the policy spectrum, you're definitely seeing, you know, there's always this tug of war between, do you start from the edges of a political spectrum and work inward, or do you start from the middle and try to get bipartisan support from the get-go? No matter what the policy is, there's always that sort of tug of war. And I think you're seeing that play out on energy and climate change issues as well. I think whenever somebody gets into power, their rhetoric often shifts. And I think you would have seen that if Clinton had won. Clinton herself, Hillary Clinton, she was a pretty centrist Secretary of State. You know, she exported the technology of fracking to countries around the world to help have other countries develop their natural gas resources, because gas was and is still seen by some as cleaner. But as in the election, when she went up against Bernie Sanders in the primary, she tacked left. I would have predicted if she would have won that she would have come back to the center. So I think in this very polarized political climate, these simple rallying cries like 100% renewable energy is very attractive. I should also note that it's also becoming feasible in some instances. Renewable energy prices for wind and solar have plummeted and have made it politically and technically feasible in many cases, but it's still not technically feasible or especially political feasible across an entire economy. So I think that is where things are going today with this generally more polarized climate. But I do think if and when a Democrat wins the presidency, that you would see somewhat of a moderating position.
So moderate Democrats or centrists within the Democratic Party, I guess their fear is that going for too many renewables in a portfolio will expose the country to much dirtier fuels, similar to what we saw in Japan after Fukushima. That nuclear was removed pretty rapidly by the Japanese government, and now you see the carbon footprint of Japan going up quite a bit. Is that valid in your estimation?
Yeah, that's precisely one of the concerns they have. I mean, there's a few concerns. I mean, that's one of them, which we've seen play out in pockets of the United States, where nuclear power plants retired, natural gas replaced it, and carbon emissions went up. That's just the cold, hard data. We've seen that happen in the Northeast and in other places. So I think that's one concern. The other concern is that renewables simply cannot power all facets of the U.S. economy or the global economy. Industrial emissions of things like cement and steel making, those processes inherent in making cement, for example, you burn off carbon emissions. So that's why some proponents of a broader portfolio mix say things like technology that captures carbon emissions from carbon-emitting facilities is essential. And if those technologies are getting pushed out of the debate today and right now, then there won't be the financial and investment and public support to have them be commercially available when the world will need them in, say, 20 to 30 to 50 years' time. These are very long and drawn out investments, and if the support isn't here now, it won't be there in 20 years, and that's what some people in the center left part of this debate are concerned about.
Well, you do terrific work, and I highly recommend our listeners go to axios.com and read your piece that we're discussing here, and we'll link to it on cchangeradio.com. People can also follow you on Twitter at Amy A. Harder. Amy Harder, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Shampoo cleaning all the windows, singing songs about it at PF Soul. and I hear blue strains of no regretting. Across the street from Cathedral Notre Dame. Meanwhile, back in San Francisco, I'm trying hard to make this whole thing blend. Yet the city pond is jagged. Story block with you, my friend. And it's a long way.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by George Lakoff. He is the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Distinguished Professor of Cognitive Science and Linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. George, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
A pleasure to be here.
So explain to us, in your view, the difference between the terms climate change and global warming, both from a messaging and linguistic standpoint, if you will.
It has to do with causation. Every language in the whole world has in its grammar, in its very grammar, the ability to express direct causation. Direct causation is something like picking up a glass. You apply a force, you move it right then. That's direct causation. And you can predict it. You know, I'm going to pick up this glass now. I just did it, okay? And you can see it, it's direct. But the environment works by systemic causation. The environment's a system. And no language in the world has systemic causation in its grammar. You have to learn about systemic causation, and it doesn't really fit conservatism that well. That is, if you think about a strict father, you know, raising his kid, it's like, do what I say now, or else I'll punish you, right? Direct causation all along. And you find direct causation as a major theme in conservatism. So you have things like, how could there be global warming? We have the biggest snowstorm in Washington we've ever seen. This climate change idea was Frank Luntz, working for Bush. Came up, said, stop, global warming sounds like it's bad, and that's caused by people. Let's go to climate change. Climate sounds nice. It sounds like Hawaii or something. You think palm trees. Change just happens. Okay, so you get climate change substituting for global warming.
Why?
Why? Because people think that weather isn't controllable. You know, you can't do anything about the weather. It's just going to happen.
See, but I remember when I hear the global warming used by Republicans saying, oh, it's really cold today. See, there's no global warming in that. And
right.
So I thought actually progressives shifted it to climate change, but it was the conservatives, you're saying.
Well, the conservatives shifted to climate change, and the progressives took it over, and they didn't use it properly. So when the conservatives said that, nobody talked about systemic causation. Why is it snowing in Washington? Because of global warming in the Pacific Ocean. Global warming in the Pacific Ocean means you have more evaporation of water than you ever had before. Nobody said Hurricane Sandy, you know, had anything to do with global warming. Because the scientists are always talking about, oh, we can't predict it. They assume science is predictive rather than explanatory. See, there's an assumption that, you know, science must be able to predict rather than explain. And most people don't understand science, and the scientists don't know how to talk about their own science. They can explain what really happened. They did. But none of them came out and said this was causation, systemic causation.
And you think that's as simple as that? If you were a politician and you were given this platform to talk about environmental issues, would you just be connecting those dots to global warming, or is there more to that, linguistically?
You have to talk about, you have to introduce language for systemic causation. You have to say, this is a system, and then you it takes 30 seconds or less to explain what happened. And you have to repeat it over and over.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to cognitive linguistics professor George Lakoff.
So in 2012, the fossil fuel companies outspent the clean energy proponents 4-1, at least. And the messaging, if you just, on a Sunday afternoon, if you're watching football and you see a few Shell or ExxonMobil or BP commercials, you're going to see these terms that are test marketed, focus grouped, up the wazoo, and I'm sure that makes someone like your blood boil when you see like energy future and our energy needs and
people energy.
People, yes, putting people to work. And so how can environmentalists compete in this? Even the term clean energy has been co-opted by the fossil fuel companies.
Right, exactly. They say, oh, yes, this is clean energy. Well, first of all, you got to talk about it as dirty energy. And you got to talk about it as destructive energy. And there's a very important thing about the environment. The word environment itself is a problem. Because the environment is outside of you, but it's really inside of you. You breathe the air, you drink the water, you eat the food. It comes inside your body.
Is nature better?
Nature is better. Nature is a lot better. It's very important to talk about nature and to talk about how you are part of, how nature is in you, not just outside of you. How nature is part of you, because in fact, there's a part of the brain that connects you to nature. Physically, your brain is physically attuned to connect you to the natural world. It is a reason why when you go to a beautiful place, you feel wonderful.
You were talking about how the conservative brain tends to come from a more authoritarian and business world. I always thought that efficiency is something that gets left off the table as a term too much when I hear the environmentalist framing things, that we always have to assume that we need to use the same amount of energy or more, and that's a given. So how do we fill those energy needs? But it's never about using less and being more efficient with our use. Why do you think that is?
Well, there's a very good reason. You don't make money that way. The gas companies don't make money that way. And this is really, the point is a really important point. The slogan comes from Benjamin Franklin. A penny saved is a penny earned. You know, an erg saved is an erg earned, right? That is, every time you don't you have to use gas, like, you know, your car has more mileage, then you don't use less gas and you put less stuff in there. That is, if you fix up your buildings in cities to use less energy, that's the equivalent of not fixing it up and using more.
How do you think the environmental movement on the whole can improve its messaging?
There's a problem in the environmental movement, which is each environmental organization has different interests and a different audience. And the CEOs of those organizations have a fiscal responsibility to raise money for their organization. And so what they say is about raising money for their organization. And they can't get a common message across for that reason. They don't know how to work together in these cases.
George Lakoff. George, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Will Bernard, Fog Swamp, and Van Morrison.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.